Hello, everybody, and welcome to a second part of a very interesting debate we're having here on Lid Radio with Philippe de Backer and Juan Gonzalez from Arthur D. Little. Philippe joining us as ever, as last time, from Dubai in the Middle East, and Juan joining us from Madrid in Spain. And last time we met, we were talking about this huge challenge that traditional banks were taking from the disruptive neobanks who have come into the sector without branches, with a low-cost base and been able to pivot and be flexible, whereas legacy banks have all manner of issues all manner of challenges that they have to tackle and lots of drags on their profitability and their success. However, we know that all is not lost for the traditional banking sector, and with wise leadership and clever strategy, perhaps there is a way out of this vicious cycle. So we're joined again, as I say, by Philippe and Juan to find out how they might escape this vortex. Philippe, we finished at the last episode about trust. It was something that Juan was mentioning, and actually one of the paradoxes of this situation is that younger consumers, we now know trust neobanks more than they do traditional banks. There was a point where having a high street branch, a big brand, a steel and glass tower would help boost your trust, and that would help increase trust, and that would be a feather in the cap for the traditional banks. That is no longer the case. Why has that changed, do you think?
Typically, banks have adopted a pull strategy, which is basically I put the infrastructure, the brick and mortar in a extensive retail footprint, and I basically count on traffic, just like any trade, in order to walk in into my branches. And the large buildings, et cetera, were expensive bulletin boards, if you will, for the banks. Today, as the preferred mode of interaction shifts to digital, not in person, it becomes a challenge to adopt this strategy. No longer works. People no longer choose to walk in the branch as their preferred mode of engaging with a financial institution. Therefore, they need to completely revamp their go-to-market model, the way they approach customers. And this is where the neobank, the technology-driven fintech, have an advantage because they understand perfectly how to leverage technology, how to apply digital marketing to engage with the target segments in a way that legacy banks are still challenged to do simply because of the internal complexity that they are facing. So we're really looking at, the change in distribution for financial institutions from legacy physical brick and mortar to a digitized mode of interaction. And that changes completely how you capture customers and how you engage with them.
Juan, a big theme in your book is the concept of ambidexterity, which speaks to this idea that if you're a traditional bank, you have to, on the one hand, you have to continue to service your traditional model. On the other hand, you have to innovate and try to move to the periphery and find new ways to take on the disruptors. Can you tell us a little bit more about the concept of ambidexterity and how one should conceive it?
Yes, of course. It's easy to see both extremes. So not being ambidextrous, but rather start by the opposite. So ambidexterity means the ability to mix both your exploring capabilities with your exploiting capabilities. So it's relatively easy to become an organization that is able to exploit their assets. So you look for efficiency, and everything is measured in terms of efficiency. And does it cost more? We stop. Does it cost less? We go. Then there's organizations that are focused on efficiency and exploiting what they have, and it's never say easy, but there's a clear path towards that you have to take. Then there are the exploratory organizations, so people who create new rules and take the risks and move forward, and they they continuously try to push the frontier, and they engage in adventurous trips and these whole things. Some of them get to the promised land. Many of them die on the way, unfortunately. So it's easy to have an organization that is either able to take the most of what they have, or an organization that is able to look for new pastures. It's extremely difficult to have an organization that is able to mix both directions of thought. So your companies that are able, and with dexterity here means understanding technology as a platform to create new services, new ways to engage with the customers, new moments of truth with your customers, at the same time being able to deliver them at a much more lower cost. Because banks at the end have to be able to understand customers, to provide credit to them, and also to deliver those services very effectively, because many of the services bank provides are pure commodities. So you cannot choose, I want to be an explorer. No, you need to be an explorer, and you need to be a very effective manager of your assets and resources. And that's the concept.
Philip, that's a fascinating dichotomy, isn't it? There's this duality between being an explorer and being an exploiter. And then within the difficult parameters of business, it's relatively easy to be one or another, is what Juan's saying. But what we really struggle with, what businesses really struggle with, is to doing both, and presumably doing both well concurrently. That is the real challenge for the banks.
Correct. And therefore, there are different models that banks can adopt in order to be able to do that. Is basically how you embed innovation in a traditional institution. How do I allocate resources appropriately? How do I build, develop, attract the right capabilities and talent to do it? Because banks are not necessarily the most attractive employers for the capabilities that be required in this new space. So how do you do that? It has been compared to trying to change a wheel while the car is driving at 300 miles an hour. And therefore, you need to basically try to either have it completely separate and then remerge. It's not always easy because a large legacy bank might just overwhelm, kill, and smother innovation simply by the internal complexity linked to size. Or the other way around, you're trying to disrupt from within and change. But ultimately, you need to pick your battles. Ultimately, you cannot do that in the model of a universal bank. And this is why we see that the stage number one of any strategy leaning towards an ambidexterity is to pick your battles, which is what are the business lines I want to deliver for which customer segments, where and how. So in a way, we have been witnessing among legacy banks the death of the universal banking model.
That's interesting, Juan, that actually, in order to do this, in order to achieve genuine ambidexterity, banks are going to have to give some things up.
Absolutely. There's no way to do the changes without deciding where to go, where to focus, where not to focus. Banks cannot continue to be the one-size-fits-all that covers every segment of the population for every service they need in every circumstance. Exactly. The reason why the new entrants are winning is because they focus on specific domains. And in those domains, they can be ambidextrous. So they can be extremely effective and efficient, and at the same time, extremely innovative. So they can provide for some segments of the population, some services in those two categories. And then they build, and then they create, and then they may decide to expand and move forward to another domain to grow in another territory. And that, to me, that being able to be ambidextrous and at the same time being able to choose forces again one more issue that is not well managed by most banks or by most incumbent organizations, by the way. Incumbents in general have a big difficulty trying to decide what businesses to shred to avoid. It's perceived as a sign of failure. It's not a failure. It's adaptation to the new environment. It's very Darwinian. Okay, it's not the largest organization that will win. It's the best fit, and you cannot be the best fit organization for every domain or territory.
Does that mean the reality of that, Philippe de Backer, is that we're going to find a situation where several banks will have to say to certain parts of their customer base, we don't want you as customers anymore?
And it will have to withdraw with entire businesses. We've seen, first of all, a withdrawal from several geographies. Some of the global banks that attempted to export a universal banking model, which is all things to all people across the globe, are retrenching through divestments. Secondly, we see that indeed the competitive position of each bank is uneven across the different business lines, and indeed they have to pick their battles, and we see some divestments, but also some acquisitions in trying to gain critical mass. But all of that in the end needs to achieve two things. One, the ability to lower the individual customer acquisition cost and lowering the cost of serving the customer. And legacy is a difficult challenge to overcome quickly. And therefore, what most banks tend to do is to buy time by putting in place a number of disruptive models in order to protect the core. Some legacy banks have, by design, created disruptive models some years ago in order to deplete the profit pool and therefore create an entry barrier to others. But ultimately, these are sort of retarding tactics as opposed to being able to stop the tidal wave that is coming, which is technology-driven, superior customer experience at the lower cost.
There's a hackneyed phrase that we use in the UK. I'm sure you may know it in your home territory, which I believe is Belgium, and although you're based in Dubai, which is that the customer is always right. And it strikes me as that isn't true, that the customer isn't always right. Because the customer for the banking sector wants multiple branches very close to his house, most of which or none of which he ever uses, which cost the banks an absolute fortune. He wants every service provider that he could possibly ever want, although most of them he will never use. And again,
up to the point where he has to pay for it.
Up to the point where he has to pay for it, yeah.
And when he has to pay for it, the trade-off becomes quite easy. He will taste convenience and lower cost any day. And although the customer stickiness of banks is known, we have seen a faster rate of attrition simply through the gain, market share gain by new entrants.
I could mention the customer is always right. It's not true that the customer always tells you the truth. So if I see how you behave, you're right, because you are behaving that way and you're going to take decisions that way. But if I ask you, would you like to have an extra serving of cream? You may say yes. You were not going to have it, but I ask you, so you tell me yes, I wouldn't have one. So the important thing is not to ask the customers. It's to understand the customers. The customers are right, but then you have to see how they behave. That's the strength that many of these companies, these new entrants have. They don't ask. Google does not ask you what you want. You simply tell them what you want, okay? So it's building on that change, shift of paradigm. Don't ask, but observe, anticipate, learn, but don't take what people tell you at face value.
You don't always believe your customer. If you believed whatever exactly they said, they would leave you only to failure
And if you ask, I will always ask for more. I mean, you ask me, yes. And I would like to have coffee when I get coffee served, and espresso, by the way, not pot coffee. Okay, because there's always this possibility to ask for more. And it's education. It's many other industries are again. It's banks sometimes believe they're in their ivory tower. Many industries are learning to do the same thing and to adapt to what people really do, not what they say they will do.
There's tough decisions ahead. We've got to learn to not trust what customers tell us, but look at what they actually do. So revealed preference, not expressed preference,
exactly
from the customer. we've got to unshackle ourselves from a whole bunch of services that aren't doing us any good as banking institutions. They're actually leading us down the route of lower profitability and higher costs, and into those areas where we can find higher profitability and lower costs. And we've got to, to some degree, say to a whole bunch of customers, whether implicitly or explicitly, we don't want you anymore. Given all of these tough decisions and hard choices that we face, Philippe de Backer, where will we find the leaders, and what sorts of leaders do we need to make these tough choices and deliver these hard decisions, and most of all, explain them to our public?
The leaders is indeed the right definition, but it's not just the CEO or the C-suite, it's also the board. And to succeed, the board and the C-suite will have to have great alignment in understanding what it will take to transform the bank. That means the ability to accept investments, restructuring, non-recurring costs, write-offs, but also shifting gears in terms of attracting the right talent, et cetera, which basically challenges the way banks have notoriously been bad at attracting, you know, high-flying talent, rewarding it along incentivized plans, which are more akin to private equity and startups. And therefore, the challenge is not just about trying to have the internal capabilities aligned, but indeed, you're quite right in continuing to attract the new breed of talent and capabilities. And banks have a huge deficit of these new skill sets that are required and that are not necessarily drawn to banks as a first port of call for employment.
Juan Gonzalez, Philippe mentioned earlier this, he used this phrase internal complexity of huge organizations in banks. And it strikes me that if we're looking for a type of leader, we've got to get a leader, yes, who has the expertise and the ideas, but also who has the strength of mind to take on what I suspect is a great degree of inertia and complexity within these organizations that at some point has got to be, for want of a better phrase, smashed up.
He has to be ambidextrous, for lack of, to continue with the same metaphor. He has to be able, or she has to be able, to push this innovation, but she has to be able to create the efficiencies that the organization needs. So it has to be someone who in every decision, because at the end of the day, these large organizations end up making decisions in boards, in committees, and in places where people make the choices. And senior management and boards are going to craft the decisions. We pay lip service to what we say. We are very innovative, but then in every decision, we stay with the traditional ways of doing things, or we always find that there's not the time yet to do this. We can wait still for more. We are in the exploiting mode, not in the exploring mode. We have all these reasons why things cannot happen. We cannot break these elements that we had in our old pottery. We keep on cleaning the pottery, but we never replace it for something else. So it's people themselves, it's the leaders, both at the C-suite and at the board, who have to have this ambidextrous mindset. And that's extremely difficult, because also our training, our behavior, our careers are typically built on one or the other. It's extremely difficult to have been trained to be flexible in both, flexible and competent. I mean, it's easy to be flexible with not being very competent on one of the domains. Being competent on both domains and being able to play simultaneously on both turfs.
Most professionals, you're saying, are actually monodextrous. They tend to be either exploiters or explorers.
Our careers, success in your career tends to move you in one direction or the other, okay? Because it may be choices made inadvertently at the beginning of your career. You move in one direction or the other, or some people, and then what brought you success at one stage in your career, you tend to repeat. It seems a natural fact of our choices, okay? So there's hammers who always look for nails. And I think that's inevitable almost. So it's really difficult to be at the same time
to be the hammer and the pen at the same time.
So be able to crack things and create new things.
Yeah.
Extremely difficult. And it's the people. And as Philippe always claims, it's we meet people, they start talking, and you discover that they feel much more comfortable in one domain or the other. And it's that's a rule to be broken.
They're led that way, Philippe de Backer, by their careers. They're more comfortable as one in one role or the other, either as the hammer or the pen, the exploiter or the explorer. My question is, can it be learned? Can a monodextrous person become an ambidextrous leader? And more to the point, can they do it quickly enough in order to be able to help the banking sector?
For that person to be able to become ambidextrous, that person has to be put in the right environment whereby he's able to try, explore, and innovate. It's a test and learn. One thing that fintech, neobanks, or any digital attackers know how to do best is the ability to experiment, allow people to test and learn, and even fail and learn from the failure, but quickly readapt, re-engage. Something which by definition is contrary to the way legacy banks have been managed,
yeah,
because they've been designed to reduce risk, try to unify the potential outcome of any decision or process, because they lived in a very static, regulated world. Now, that entity, which is like in a straitjacket, is asked to become nimble,
yeah,
agile, etc. So it is not just a question of asking the person to become, but the institution has to allow for that ambidexterity to emerge.
That's fascinating, isn't it, Juan? That in order for ambidextrous leaders to emerge, one has to create an environment in which they can emerge. And that, to me, is the real challenge.
To me, it's the board that can play that role, because the board is not one person. Board should be able to bring people and the skills from both domains, and then be able to discuss at what is the right level, the right mix of exploitation and exploration that we need at this point in time, given the strategic roadmap that we're evolving. So I think it's a big issue, a big responsibility of boards, to think not only in terms of immediate results, but also to lead the transformation, managing both directions, which at sometimes could think as opposite directions, but which in fact we believe are essential for future success.
So if the board sets the environment, it sets the direction, it sets the mentality and the culture of the business, there is a chance we can develop the ambidexterity we need for the legacy banks to thrive and take on the disruptions. I have to ask, as we come to our end of our second and final episode on this, how optimistic are you, gentlemen, that this will happen?
I'm fairly optimistic that winners will emerge in a hybrid model, but it will be the result of a bloody consolidation. And not just on the legacy side, I think the concern should also be on the digital attackers, neobanks, and fintech. It is today a very crowded field, and therefore very few will emerge as global leaders. Some of them of these market segments are mature now, and global leaders in different fields such as payments have emerged. We've mentioned previously Stripe as being a giant who emerged, fast growth, etc. These are winners for the future. But also, we will see legacy banks who will emerge in the future. One can notice the wonderful transformation that JP Morgan in the US has managed to do. I think they have applied the playbook extremely successfully. And have navigated well during this transformation, but it's only begun. This transformation consolidation has just begun.
Juan Gonzalez, winners will emerge, but it will be a bloody battle to get there.
Banking remains essential. There will be providers of banking services. They may not look like the ones that we know today, there will be winners, and they will blend the best of traditional and new and adapt to the new conditions. But it's like investing in the Dow Jones of 1910. Those companies no longer exist, but the Dow Jones continues. So banking, as I say, banking remains essential. We will find new players. They will not look like the ones. And it's not the fact that banks remain like the name bank, but the functions they provide will remain. And there will be winners who are able to serve their customers with the most appropriate combination of service, trust, simplicity, whatever the market needs at the time. The function would not go away.
It'll be interesting to meet with you again in a few years' time to see how the analysis fared and where we ended up. But it's fascinating to talk to you both about what is an absolutely extraordinary development in the sector, one that we're going to all be watching closely with interest. Juan Gonzalez, Philippe de Backer, thank you very much for joining us on Lid Radio today.
Thank you.
Thank you.